I'm Kennedy Ferrugia with Pharmacy Times, and you're listening to Pharmacy Focus Oncology Edition, where we break down the latest news in the oncology pharmacy space. Assistant Editor Aaron Hunter spoke with Bobby Green, MD, President and Chief Medical Officer at Time Care in Nashville, Tennessee. They discuss the updated version of the oncology care model and how it incentivizes value-based care over volume.
Jumping right into it, I wanted to start broadly. I like the philosophy that sometimes people say where if you know something, you can explain it to a five-year-old. And so as if you were explaining the enhancing oncology model to a group of young listeners, how would you, in layman's term, describe what this is and what this means for patients?
Yeah. So I love the framing of the question, Aaron. So in healthcare as a rule, this is not specific to oncology, we live in what's called a fee-for-service environment. And all that means is that in healthcare, every time a doctor or a hospital or a radiology center, anytime they perform a service, they get paid for that service. So if I walk into an examination room as an oncologist and I see a patient and I do a note on the patient and I make a decision about that patient, if that patient has Medicare, I submit a bill to Medicare and Medicare pays me for what I did. If I order a CAT scan that's done at a hospital down the street, that CAT scan gets done. That hospital sends the bill to Medicare, and Medicare pays the bill for that. So there are all these things that get done, and there is a charge for them, and the payer, in this case Medicare, pays for them. And it's called fee for service because you get paid a fee for every service that you do. And the only way you get paid is by doing things. And sort of the global problem with this fee-for-service model is that the more you do, the more you get paid. And so it inherently incentivizes volume. And there are only a limited number of things for which there are codes that you actually get paid for. But the reality is in medical practice, there are lots of things that you could do, should do, would like to do, but they don't get that actually provide value to patients, but you don't get paid for them. And so the fact that you don't get paid for certain things results in disincentivizing those things getting done, or making them impractical. So like, just to give you an example, I just mentioned the case of if a patient comes into my office, I can see the patient and I can examine the patient and I can bill Medicare for that and I'm gonna get paid for that. And it's important to do that, right? As a clinician, you need to like see patients and take care of them and you should get paid for that. But if I've given a patient chemotherapy and it's a week after their chemotherapy, and I know it would be helpful for that patient if I called them on the phone to check on them. And not only would it be helpful, but if I asked them a bunch of symptoms that they had, I could maybe find, oh, they're having nausea. Maybe that nausea is going to get worse in a few days and is going to put them in the hospital. And if I actually found that patient a week later, identified that they had nausea, I could do something about it, which would prevent them from ending up in the hospital 3 days later or a week later. And boy, I should do that because not only is that the right thing for the patient, but ultimately it's going to save money for Medicare because it's going to prevent a hospital admission that Medicare was going to have to pay for. And guess what? Medicare should pay me or pay the practice or pay someone to reach out to that patient a week after they get their treatment so that you can identify these symptoms and keep people from going to the hospital, because that's good for the patient. And it actually saves money to pay me to reach out. At the end of the day, is going to save money, because it's going to keep that patient, that's going to keep that patient out of the hospital. But the reality is, that's not how the world works. So there are a lot of things like that reach out a week after chemotherapy that are not reimbursed. And it's expensive for practices to do that. It costs money. You have to hire a nurse. You have to have the nurse call the patient a week later. Operationally, it's complex. Okay, I need to keep track of all the people who are starting treatment on a Monday and make sure we call them, you know, whatever it is, 3 days later or a week later. And if they don't pick up the phone, I want to make sure I call them again. Or maybe there's technology I could buy that would allow me to text the patient to ask for their symptoms. But all these things are hard and they cost money and no one's paying for them. And so there are all these things that don't get done. Sort of the key is, in a fee-for-service model, there are only specific things that get paid for. That encourages volume over value. And at the same time, there are lots of other things that could be done, should be done. And in oncology practice specifically, a lot of them do get done, but there are just a bunch of other things that don't, because no one's willing to pay for them. And it's a shame, because they could drive a lot of value. So in a value-based arrangement, this is sort of the key point, in a value-based arrangement, you change the reimbursement system one way or the other to put value on doing the things that are good for patients that aren't currently reimbursed, and that very often will reduce the total cost of care. And the example I just use here is, come up with a model that will incentivize practices, incentivize clinics, incentivize hospitals to do the things that drive higher value care and that don't just drive volume.
Thank you so much for that explanation. That was lovely to hear it in context. I enjoyed how you broke that down too. So I very much appreciate that. And since this is the enhancing oncology model, so this is the idea, right? Now that I hear it, it's going more towards value. How is it addressing some of the high cost areas that you kind of mentioned, the things like the hospital bills, like the things we could be doing? In other ways, how is it incentivizing this value-based care? And what does that look like in terms of finances, costs, and exchanges?
So, Erin, great question again. And at a very high level, there are really two financial components to the model. The first financial component is what CMS has said is, for every patient who is enrolled in this model, we are going to pay you a monthly payment to do all of these high value things, which sort of fall under the umbrella of cancer navigation. Okay, so we're going to pay you for every patient that you're taking care of, for every month that they're in the program. We're going to send you a check. That check in the enhancing oncology model is for $70. It's called a MEOS, M-E-O-S payment. And we're going to pay you to cover the cost of you doing these things that are going to deliver value. Now, one of the criticisms of the enhancing oncology model is that monthly payment was significantly less than in the prior version of this. And a lot of practices, I think legitimately, will argue that the amount of dollars that is paid by CMS doesn't actually cover all of the costs that oncology practices are being asked to do as part of this program. But from a financial perspective, one of the big components is, hey, practice, we're going to give you money to allow you to perform these value-based interventions on patients. The second component is CMS basically saying, you're going to have some skin in the game. And what that means is that if by participating in this program, by doing these activities, and again, I'll just use the example, reaching out to a patient after chemotherapy to assess symptoms. If you do these things, which should deliver higher value care, Okay. And remember, part of higher value care is not just delivering really good care and high quality care, but lowering the cost of care. So if you deliver really high value care, then the cost to Medicare for the patients you're managing ought to be less than it would have been if you weren't participating in this program, or more importantly, should be less than other practices that have chosen not to participate in this program. And if you do spend less money, we're going to share some of that money with you. Okay, so you're now financially incentivized to do things that are good for patients, but that also can lower the total cost of care. And not only, but you have skin in the game. So not only are we willing to share savings, but if you don't save money, if you cost more money, then you're going to have to pay us some of the excess cost that you're spending. So, and it's what is called in the enhancing oncology model as a two-sided risk, meaning you have upside as a practice, but you also have downside as a practice. And that's another contrast, Aaron, with the first iteration of this, which was the oncology care model. In the oncology care model, by definition, every practice had some upside benefit, the ability to share in the savings if they lowered the cost of care, but whether or not to take downside risk was optional in the oncology care model. In the new model, the enhancing oncology model, EOM, if you participate in the program, you must take some degree of downside risk. And that's scary if you're a practice, right? Because most oncology practices, most practices in general, forget about the specialty, don't have a lot of experience with how do I take risk. And if you look at it from the perspective of an independent practice as opposed to a hospital system, you know, if you have a 10-doctor practice or 20-doctor practice or whatever, what that means is at the end of the program, there's a chance Medicare is going to say, hey, practice, you owe us, you know, X dollars, and people are, you know, it's not exactly happening like this, but people are basically, you know, writing checks back to the government, which, you know, no one wants to do and can be scary. The key thing to remember is the program itself is voluntary. So the practices that sign up are choosing to sign up. Once they go into the program, they know that with every 6-month episode, because this sort of the program is in 6-month blocks, every 6-month block, at some point in the future, because it takes time to reconcile this, CMS is going to look at the data and they're either going to say, here's some money, it's break even, or give us some money.
So are you noticing differences in what value-based oncology now looks like?
So I would say the biggest difference in the landscape is just that there's more familiarity with it. And for the practices that participated in the oncology care model, there's some experience. Certainly, if the EOM, the way it was rolled out now, if the program had looked like that in 2014, I think you would have had very, very few people would have enrolled, because a lot of the practices that are enrolling in EOM now, where there's mandatory two-sided risk, are doing it because they have some degree of comfort for having done the oncology care model. You know, I think I'd like to tell you the other thing that's different is like most cancer care is delivered under value-based arrangements right now as a consequence of the oncology care model, that tons of health plans have followed on, et cetera, et cetera. That's actually not true. You know, unfortunately, to date, the vast majority of cancer care is still delivered under this fee-for-service model. So there is, I mean, I think that's part of the excitement around EOM, is that hopefully it continues to sort of push things in the right direction. I will say, though, that there are some where there are big differences, and I don't know if you were also getting at this, and I'm happy to answer that as well. There are some really big differences between the enhancing oncology model now and the oncology care model before. So the programs themselves do have some fundamental differences, some of which are, you know, I don't want to say good or bad, some of which are viewed very positively by the oncology community, but honestly, some which were viewed I think appropriately, from with a concerning or worrisome lens as well.
Awesome. Thank you. Great explanation. For a lot of our oncologists in smaller scale health systems, I feel like it could be a little harder to weigh those risks because they don't have the support of a big system. How should they approach this model?
I think as people were considering this, Erin, you're 100% right. Like a lot of the reasons that honestly, both some smaller practices and quite honestly, some bigger, more sophisticated practices, a lot of the reasons that they didn't participate was, concern about the lower MIOS payment that I mentioned, concerned about the mandatory risk without understanding that there was a clear enough path or really having had enough time to understand their own data to be comfortable taking that risk. The fact that there is a lot of operational and analytic resources that go into being successful there. And to your point, especially, I think for smaller practices and smaller practices that hadn't done this before in the OCM, it was really difficult. I think one of the things that we saw, and this is just sort of based on both, my experience because I've been in the space and talking to a lot of oncologists who I interact with. I think part of the things that got practices comfortable with doing this was having the right partners and support to think about how are we going to tackle these operational issues? How are we going to do the analytics in the program? It's one of the, again, to people, the advice I would give in general to practices, even those that are, now committed to going forward, is just making sure that you have the right partners in place and the right analytic support, the right operational support. And depending on the practice, some of that will be skill sets that you have internally. Some of that will be assist that you need from, external third parties and vendors as well. So.
Thank you so much. What I was wondering now is how will the new model change access to novel therapies and clinical trials?
It's a great question. I will answer it in two ways, maybe two, maybe more. So I think one of the overarching concerns is that in a model like this, where you are incentivized to spend less money, the concern is obviously, well, novel therapies are expensive. Is that just going to discourage oncologists from using novel therapies? I'll just sort of say as a caveat, as someone, again, who's been practicing for 25 years, I think the risk of that happening at baseline is quite low because I think that, oncologists are out there taking care of patients and doing what is right for their patients at baseline. But one of the nice things about the enhancing oncology model is there is something built in there to take into account not just the use of novel therapies, because when the costs are compared, they're compared to groups that are not participating in the enhancing oncology model. So that's one way to sort of mitigate the risk if you're in a practice that you're going to get penalized for using new drugs. And there's also something called the novel therapy adjustment that's built into the enhancing oncology model that prevents or that actually takes into account, well, what happens if I'm a practice and I'm on the cutting edge of, giving new therapies when they come out, because that's the right things for my patients. I don't want to get penalized for that. And the novel therapy adjuster at least is attempting to address that. I think with all these models, and by the way, there are improvements that were made to that in the enhancing oncology model compared to the OCM. I think at the end of the day, it's sometimes hard to be confident when a model like this is starting, how well or not is that going to work? But there is something in there that is to account for that. And honestly, I do not worry in the context of practices that are in the EOM at all that patients are going to be denied access to novel therapies that are going to benefit them. That I have lots of things that keep me up at night. That doesn't keep me up at night because I'm not worried about that happening. As far as clinical trials go, a nice part of the enhancing oncology model is that their practices are actually incentivized for a couple of reasons to enroll more patients on clinical trials. So if anything, this should be helpful for clinical trial accrual and definitely not harmful.
I would just love to end by getting some of your sage advice. What would be one thing you'd want to tell oncologists who are participating in EOM, and how can they optimize being a part of the system?
I'm always hesitant to tell my colleagues things, because one thing about the oncology community is it's a pretty closed, tight-knit community. And I think that across the board, our practices, and specifically the oncologists who are the physician leaders at these practices, both the ones who've participated and who haven't participated, I think really deeply understand the issue. I mean, listen, I think the key things are, which, you know, is this is patient-focused, a patient-focused intervention, and it should always be a patient-focused intervention, and sort of keeping the eye on that. And then, you know, I think making sure that you have the right partners to go through this. And because I think there's some practices can do a lot of this. Some practices can only do a little of this. I don't think there's anyone out there who can do the whole thing soup to nuts without having the right partner. You know, there are practices in various groups that have those and have access to those. And I think it's just really important to leverage those as we move forward. And, you know, listen, I think there was a lot of debate about the EOM. I think there were things that a lot of practices that didn't like, that a lot of things that a lot of practices didn't like. I think the participation is unfortunately lower than I think all of us would have liked. But I think there are a lot of really important, influential practices that are in this and are in this to be successful at it. And, you know, I think it's an exciting thing, and it's going to be a big part of the conversation and the things that we're all talking about going forward.